Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fascinating legal puzzle, one that's especially relevant for you navigating law school. The case of Wolf v. District of Columbia from 1991. Think of it as, you know, cutting through the legal jargon to get to the core of a property tax fight.
Exactly. At its heart, this case is about something pretty fundamental. How do we actually determine the fair market value of a commercial property? And importantly, what can owners do when they really, really disagree with the city's number? We're going to dissect the legal ideas here and look at the, well, the real challenges in contesting these valuations.
Yeah, our goal today is to give you a solid handle on this case, the facts, the main legal arguments, and how the court ultimately landed. I'll be focusing more on the timeline, the sequence of events, while our expert here.
I'll be focusing on the legal standards, the principles, and maybe the broader implications for property tax law generally.
Right. And hopefully, by the time we're done, you'll have a clear picture of how these disputes work and the key things the legal system considers.
Yeah, should be helpful.
So let's set the scene. The property we're talking about is a 12-story office building. It's at 1001 Connecticut Avenue, right in the heart of D.C. Now, great location, obviously, but the case mentions it was an older building, built in the 50s, hadn't been renovated yet.
And location is huge in real estate, as they say. But yeah, an older, unrenovated building, even in a prime spot, presents its own valuation challenges. And that's really where the friction started.
Right. So the tax years in question are 1986 and 1987. But let's back up just a bit to 85. For that year, the district initially proposed a pretty hefty $14.6 million assessment. After an appeal, that got knocked down to $13.5 million. But then, and here's the twist for 86, the city went back and used that original higher figure, $14.6 million.
Which, yeah, you can imagine didn't exactly thrill the property owners. They must have felt like, wait a minute, we just went through this, especially after getting it lowered the year before.
They definitely did. The owners, the Wolf family and Charles Goldsmith, argued that a much fairer value for 86 would be $10.3 million. And interestingly, that $10.3 million, that was the building's assessed value back in 1984. So you can see they felt the city was kind of going backward.
That is a substantial difference. We're talking millions of dollars, and that difference directly impacts their tax bill significantly. So challenging it makes perfect sense from their perspective.
And challenge it they did. It ended up in court. The trial court actually appointed an independent expert, a guy named William Harps, to do his own appraisal. His valuation ended up somewhere in the middle, you know, between the city's 14.6 mil and the owner's 10.3 mil.
That's pretty standard practice, actually, in these sorts of valuation fights.
Yeah.
Bringing in a neutral third party, an expert, can give the court a more objective view on what's often a very technical and complex assessment.
But even with Harps's independent number, the owners still weren't satisfied. They decided to appeal. And it's really at the appellate stage that the core legal arguments about the methods used come into sharp focus. They weren't just saying the number was wrong. They argued the way the valuations were done was flawed.
Exactly. That's the key distinction. They weren't just quibbling over the final dollar amount. They were attacking the process, the data, the methodology used to get to that amount.
Mm.
And generally, to win a tax assessment challenge, you really need to show a flaw in the method, not just that you disagree with the final number.
Okay, so let's get into those methods. The case talks about two main ways to value property, the income approach and the comparable sales approach. Can you break those down for us, especially for commercial property?
Sure. The income approach, well, basically, it looks at the money the property can make. Appraisers project future income from rent, subtract operating costs to get the net operating income, or NOI. Then they apply something called a capitalization rate. Think of it like the expected rate of return for an investor to that NOI to estimate the property's value. The basic idea is a property's worth is tied to how much income it generates.
Okay, that makes sense. Like valuing a business based on profits. What about the comparable sales approach? That sounds maybe simpler.
It often feels more intuitive, yeah.
Yeah.
You look at recent sales of similar properties, similar size, location, condition, features. The tricky part, of course, is finding properties that are truly comparable. Then the appraiser adjusts the sale prices of those comps to account for differences compared to the property being valued.
So in Wolf, what specifically did the owners object to about how these were applied? Where did they see the flaws?
Okay. Their main issue with the income approach was about the data Mr. Harps, the independent expert, used. He apparently used the actual net income figures from the 1987 tax year to help figure out the value for the 1986 tax year. The owners argued pretty strongly that this was wrong because Well, nobody buying the property on January 1st, 1986, the valuation date, could possibly have known the actual 1987 income figures yet.
Right, I get that. It feels like using hindsight, doesn't it? How can you value something on day X using data from day Y, which hasn't happened yet? A buyer couldn't know that.
That was exactly their point. They felt it wasn't realistic, not what a buyer would have known or reasonably projected at that specific time. But, and this is important, the court pointed to an earlier case, Safeway Stores, Inc. v. District of Columbia. That case basically said appraisers have some flexibility. They can consider various factors and methods to get to a reasonable fair market value. In Wolf, the court decided that using actual post-valuation date income data to help figure out a stabilized net income projection wasn't automatically wrong.
Huh. So the court is saying later information can shed light on the property's value at an earlier date, even if it wasn't known then.
Sort of, yeah. The idea is that later performance can give insight into the property's underlying long-term income potential as of the valuation date. It's about creating a reliable picture of stabilized income, not perfect foresight. It helps inform the estimate of its intrinsic value then.
Interesting. Okay, what about the comparable sales approach? The owners had problems there too, right?
They did. They argued the property TARPs used as comparables weren't really similar enough to 1001 Connecticut Avenue. And they also argued the trial judge didn't look closely enough at how similar or different they were.
And how did the appeals court handle that argument?
This is where a really key legal concept comes in, something crucial for law students. The clearly erroneous standard of review. The appellate court basically said, look, the trial judge gets a lot of discretion in weighing expert evidence and deciding who's more credible. Unless the trial judge's factual findings are clearly erroneous, meaning the appeals court is absolutely convinced a mistake was made, they won't overturn those findings.
So it's a high bar to clear.
A very high bar.
Yeah.
In Wolf, the owners essentially just disagreed with Harps's professional judgment about which properties were good comps and how to adjust for differences. But disagreeing isn't enough. They didn't show the appellate court that the trial judge was clearly wrong to accept Harps's analysis.
So just saying I disagree with the expert or here are some other properties I think are better comps, that doesn't cut it on appeal.
Not usually, no. The burden was on the owners to prove Harps's comps were fundamentally flawed, legally invalid, not just that they liked other ones better. It's also worth noting they tried to introduce their own valuation method based on a debt coverage formula. The trial court didn't buy it, said it wasn't well supported, and the appellate court agreed. The court stressed again, the taxpayer has to prove the government's method is irrational or that their own method is clearly better.
Got it. So the appeals court really deferred to the trial court as the main fact finder here.
Absolutely. Appellate courts usually give a lot of weight, a lot of deference to the trial court's view of the facts and expert credibility.
Now, there was also a concurring opinion by Judge Schwelb. He agreed with the final outcome, but raised some points, right?
Yes. Judge Schwelb's concurrence is interesting. He agreed they had to affirm the trial court's decision, but he definitely expressed some unease about the district's actions. He specifically pointed out that the $14.6 million figure for 1986 was the exact same number the Board of Equalization had already rejected as too high for 1985. He called that disturbing.
Yeah, that does seem odd. Why reuse a number already deemed too high?
Exactly. Schwell worried it could discourage taxpayers from challenging assessments they think are unfair, you know, if they feel like their earlier successful challenges are just ignored. He saw the potential for unfairness, maybe even arbitrary action. But despite that concern, he concluded the appellate court was still stuck with the clearly erroneous standard. Since he couldn't say the trial judge was clearly wrong to accept Harps' independent valuation, he felt he had to concur, even with those reservations.
So even if the government's process looks a bit questionable, that clearly erroneous standard is still a massive hurdle for the taxpayer.
That's a huge takeaway from his concurrence. It really shows the tension between wanting fair taxes and the practical limits of how appeals courts review complex facts decided by trial courts. Even if something feels off, the legal standard to overturn is deliberately high.
Okay, so let's wrap this up. If you had to boil it down, what are the, say, three most critical takeaways from Wolf v. DC for our law student listeners?
Okay. Three key points. First, and we've hit this hard, the burden of proof on taxpayers challenging assessments is significant. You can't just say it's wrong. You have to show the government's method is irrational or your method is demonstrably better.
Makes sense. The assessment is presumed correct until proven otherwise, essentially.
Pretty much. Second, appellate courts give huge deference to trial judges' factual findings, especially when based on expert testimony. That clearly erroneous standard means unless there's a definite firm conviction of a mistake, the appeals court won't step in. Just disagreeing with the expert, like the wolves did with Harps, wasn't enough.
Right. The trial judge accepting Harps' view was a major obstacle on appeal.
Definitely. And third, appraisers have flexibility in choosing and applying valuation methods. The court confirmed that both income and comparable sales approaches are generally fine for commercial property. And crucially, using some post-valuation data isn't automatically forbidden if it helps paint a more reliable picture of the property's stabilized income potential as of the valuation date.
So the experts get a fair bit of leeway in how they arrive at their value, as long as the method is sound.
They do, provided it's professionally recognized and the conclusions are reasonably supported. And as Judge Schwell pointed out, even questionable government actions like reusing that old assessment number might still stand up on appeal because of that deference to the trial court's findings.
So what seems unfair isn't always legally wrong. At least not wrong enough to overturn.
That's a really critical point about the practical limits of judicial review in these technical cases.
Well, this has been incredibly insightful, a real deep dive into Wolfie DC. It certainly highlights just how complex these property tax disputes can be and the hurdles taxpayers face.
It really does. And hopefully this discussion has given you, our listeners, a clearer, more nuanced grasp of the legal principles involved.
Absolutely. So here's a final thought for you to chew on as you continue your studies. Thinking about this balanced fair taxation versus the practical limits of court review, how do you think that clearly erroneous standard really shapes future tax disputes? And knowing these constraints, what strategies might a taxpayer and their lawyer actually use to effectively challenge an assessment? It's definitely a complex mix of law and reality to keep exploring. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.